This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest making his third appearance on our show is my favorite celebrity biographer. He's written 21 books, 17 of which have made the New York Times bestseller list. His immensely popular biographies about superstars like Marilyn Monroe, Frank Sinatra, Elizabeth Taylor, Carol Burnett, Cher, Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Madonna, and Beyoncé are widely considered to be balanced, definitive, and authoritative. He's also one of the world's foremost historians about the Kennedy family, having now written 6 books about them. Those books are Jackie, Ethel, Joan, Women of Camelot, After Camelot, A Personal History of the Kennedy Family, 1968 to the Present, Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, The Kennedy Heirs, John, Caroline, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Tragedy and Triumph, Jackie, Public, Private, Secret, and now his brand new book entitled JFK, Public, Private, Secret. This meticulously researched and highly compelling book is not a presidential biography that analyzes every move President Kennedy made as a politician. And the book doesn't delve deeply into the conspiracy theories about his death. Heaven knows there are enough books about all of that. What our guest has given us in his latest book is the chance to finally get to know the real John Fitzgerald Kennedy, not just the dazzlingly captivating politician, but more importantly, Jack Kennedy, the son, brother, husband, father, friend, and human being that he was in his real life, with not only all of his strengths and virtues, but also his flaws and inner turmoil. I'm delighted to welcome J. Randy Taraborelli back to our show. Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm so happy to see your face, Harvey. This is our third, right? It's amazing, you know, and I love your show. You've come such a long way from the first time that we did it. I'm just so proud of you, and I'm so happy to be back.
Well, you are a good luck charm for me. Thank you for those very kind words. Randy, let's get the obvious question out of the way first. This is your 6th book about the Kennedys. Why did you feel the world needed another book about JFK?
Well, I felt when Jackie, Public Private Secret, became so big a book for me, I felt that I wanted to tell his side of the story. I've written about Jackie in so many different iterations, you know, from, you know, Jackie Ethel Joan, Jackie Janet Lee, you know, After Camelot, Jackie Public Private Secret. And I felt like I had a lot of questions about JFK's behavior in his marriage to Jackie, and that now was the time to sort of tell his side of the story. And also, I just needed some explanation for my own edification. I just wondered why he made some of the decisions that he made, and I needed to find out. And so I embarked on this journey.
Well, as usual, your research is impeccable. For the benefit of our viewers, I want to mention that you had access to Joseph Kennedy's unpublished memoir and to 2 unpublished transcripts of interviews with Jackie's mother, Janet. You also had access to the unpublished memoir of Joan Lundberg, one of the women JFK had an affair with. You got the unpublished memoir of Dr. Max Jacobson, the infamous Dr. Feelgood, who gave JFK injections of speed. How do you manage to get access to information nobody else can get?
Well, you know, I've got an incredible researcher who's been with me for 30 years named Kathy Griffin, not the comedian, a better Kathy Griffin than even that. She, for me anyway, she's a great researcher, and she tracks down these amazing manuscripts and interviews. And also, you know, I'm really lucky that I have a really good reputation that I've worked really hard on over the last 30 years. And people come to me, you know, with surprising things that I didn't even ask for. I didn't know that Joan Lundberg had a manuscript. I actually had never even heard of her prior to this book. and which is amazing in and of itself, that new people came to me when I was writing this book that I had no idea had even existed in his world, let alone a manuscript by her. So I've been very fortunate to sort of have a network of Kennedy sources that I've built over the last six, seven books, and they always come through for me.
I think that you reap what you sow, particularly in your line of work and your reputation for integrity and for being balanced and fair really has stood you in good stead, not only with your readers, but with the sources that you rely on. And in addition to all of the research I just mentioned, you, of course, had all the research you did for your first five Kennedy books. With all of that information you acquired, what would you say was the most surprising thing you learned about JFK in writing this book?
Well, I think that when you zero in on a person's life, you're going to find moments that are, not him at his best, and then you're going to, find better moments along the way. And in JFK's case, he started out his life very entitled, very selfish, an incredible lack of empathy. And as you read in my book, he went on this journey to becoming a better man. And in the process, a better leader. And I found what I didn't expect in this book was because of the tragic nature of the ending, I was surprised by sort of the hopeful message that I was able to impart in this book. And I think that in this fractured world right now that we live in, a hopeful message is, sort of the best thing that you can do as a writer. And the hopefulness of JFK's story is that he became a better person, and he's not the same guy at the end of the book that he is at the beginning. And I think that I love that about the story. I didn't know that I was going to be able to tell this kind of a story about a man who took accountability for his mistakes and was trying at the end of his life to be a better person.
Yes, it's very clear in your book. His character was evolving, and around the time of his death, he clearly made a decision to confront his demons. We're going to talk a bit about that. But first, I have to mention, Randy, your book has a very interesting structure. The story's not chronological. What was the thinking behind that?
My thinking, I've done this in all of my books. My thinking basically is that I'm trying to keep the reader engaged, and I'm trying to be to surprise the reader. And I think that, a strictly chronological accounting of a person's life is something that you can count on Wikipedia for. In my storytelling division, I want to, sort of jump around in time and keep people wondering what's going to happen next, and not just have them know because they happen to know the story, and it's fun for me and as a writer to, to sort of jump around in time. Now, Harvey, I have gotten some reviews from, some of my Amazon readers who you don't like that. They say, why can't this guy keep a timeline? I can't follow it. I can't figure out what's going on. My best advice is pay attention. My best advice is don't read the book while you're watching TV. Don't read the book while you're talking to your kids. If you really, really, really want to get it, you have to actually pay attention to the book because it takes a little bit of effort to follow some of my storytelling, but I hope that in the end it's worth it.
It is worth it. And my message to somebody who would make that kind of critique is pay attention to the themes. Randy is a man who writes in a very connected way about certain themes. And if he's chosen to go back in time, think about what he just wrote about and think about the theme that he's trying to impress upon you. That's the way I read the book. Now, it's often said that every great man in history has that one seminal moment in his life that defines who he is, how the world will see him forever. In your opinion, what was that moment for JFK?
Well, there were so many different moments like that in his life and times, but I think, as a leader, there were two. There was the Bay of Pigs, which was, a Cuban invasion in which JFK inherited this sort of debacle from the Eisenhower administration. And it ended up, being very poorly executed, and many people lost their lives. And I think the reason that this is a seminal moment was because it was Jack Kennedy's decision to take accountability for this mistake and not blame the previous guy in office and not blame the fact that he had inherited this mess from somebody else. He fell on his sword. He said, "This was my decision. This was my problem, and I take full responsibility for it." And guess what, Harvey? As a result of that, his approval rating went all the way up to 85%. And I think that that really shows us what people want in a leader of this country, is they want accountability. So that was a big moment for him. The next big moment for him politically was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that happened about a year later. And rather than listen to the people in his cabinet who had, and in the CIA who had steered him wrong and with the Bay of Pigs, he listened to his own gut and to his own instinct and to his own counsel. And he made decisions that kept us from becoming completely annihilated in what was potentially a nuclear war. And as I wrote in the book, you have to wonder if the tables had been turned, if the incidents had been switched, how this might have turned out, had he not learned from the Bay of Pigs that you cannot listen to everybody in your cabinet. You've got to listen to your heart, and that's what he did with the Cuban Missile Crisis and prevented a nuclear war. So obviously that was a seminal moment as well in terms of his leadership.
You also wrote about the seminal moment that turned him from an entitled young man who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth to a person who developed a social conscience. And that moment was his heroism during the war in the Pacific in 1943. That was really significant for his character as well, wasn't it?
You're right, Harvey. That was, we're talking about PT 109, and which, he saved, his crew after they were rammed by a Japanese ship. And my gosh, he actually dragged one guy through the ocean, with his teeth on this man's life vest. It was, an incredible story of heroism. And I think that you're right. This was another big moment for him. He was raised in a household that didn't have an emphasis on empathy. And they were really, entitled and selfish. And I mean that not in a strictly pejorative way, but in a way that this was just the way they were raised. And so they had to come out, the Kennedys had to come out of this household into the real world and become empathetic about people. And this was a challenge, for all of them. And it's interesting that Joe Kennedy told Jackie at one point that, he said that I wanted to teach my son pain, because even Joe felt that a lack of empathy was not going to serve JFK well as a politician. He was thinking about it politically. He wasn't even thinking about it as a human being. And he told Jackie, "I wanted to teach him pain." And I think that in Joe's kind of skewed logic, what he was trying to say was that you've got to understand the human condition, and you've got to understand people, and you have to suffer sometimes in order to do that. And some of these politicians that we've seen over the years who've never had to suffer a moment in their lives, are the politicians who generally cannot relate to the human condition, and they're not good leaders.
In your book, we learn a lot about JFK's flaws, especially his infidelity. Your book makes the important point, Randy, that sometimes a fundamentally decent person can do bad things. And it's clear that the media protected him in a way that would never happen nowadays. Do you think, with all his faults, that JFK could ever have been elected today?
Well, I'll tell you the thing, Harvey. If you had asked me this 10 years ago, my answer would be absolutely not. But I think that what we've seen in the last 10 years is all bets are off. Is what we're experiencing right now How does that compare to, JFK was, unfaithful to his wife? That was his biggest flaw for that the media could have reported on. Today, that would mean nothing, And so I think that to answer your question today, I think yes, I think that he would have been, he would sail right through and no one would think a thing about it. 10 years ago, I don't think that would have been possible, but we've changed a lot in this country in the last 10 years, and we accept an awful lot more in our leaders than we ever would have accepted in the past.
You just said a mouthful, my friend. When you look at how JFK was raised, Randy, his mother Rose was emotionally detached. She lacked warmth and compassion. His father Joe was a manipulative, controlling, sometimes ruthless businessman and a womanizer. He viewed politics as a way to be upwardly mobile and wealthy and powerful, certainly not as an instrument of achieving social justice. With parents like that, isn't it surprising that JFK actually turned out to be as good a president as he was?
I think you make a good point, Harvey. I think that it is surprising, and I think that this is where Jackie comes in. What I loved about this story was that Jackie is instrumental in opening up JFK to empathy when it was her decision that he needed to meet and go back and reacquaint himself with the sister of his, Rosemary, who had been institutionalized by the father. And, the family had just been told to just forget that she existed. And they just lived for many years as if she never was. And when Jackie had a stillbirth of a child that she named Arabella, and JFK showed such a stunning lack of empathy toward her. He actually didn't even return home from a vacation to be at her side. I think it was such a shock to her and to everybody else that Jackie really wanted to get to the bottom of it. This was her husband. What is wrong with this guy? And when she discovered that Rosemary was institutionalized and that JFK had not had anything to do with her, her response to that is, how is he supposed to feel sympathy and sadness over a daughter that he never even met if he can't even feel it for his own sister who's lost to him? So she went about the business of reconnecting JFK to Rosemary, and she did reconnect him to her. And that began a sort of a an avalanche of change in JFK's life. If it had been left up to his mother and father, he never would have connected to his sister. So I really give a lot of credit to Jackie in this book for being sort of the catalyst for great change in JFK emotionally.
Well, I have to say that the chapter about Rosemary is, in my opinion, one of the most poignant and heartbreaking, heart-wrenching chapters you've ever written. Now, you mentioned Jackie. Well, I hear what you're saying, but in my understanding, through your books, Jackie was raised to believe that the secret to a happy marriage was money and power. JFK was raised in a basically loveless marriage. Your description of their courtship makes it clear they were certainly not head over heels in love with each other. It felt very transactional. So let me ask you this: if JFK had not had political aspirations, would he have married Jackie?
Good question, Harvey. And my speculation is no. They weren't crazy in love with each other. It was a match that was sort of put together. It's an arranged marriage, like many royal marriages. It was kind of put together by his father and kind of foisted upon him. I mean, he was 36 years old. He needed to get married if he was going to be president. But I think that even though Jackie was raised the way that she was raised, she began to fall in love with him, and I think a key ingredient to this story is this woman that we haven't really mentioned yet, but I can't help but tell you that Joan Lundberg had a lot to do with this.
Oh, we're
Joan
going to get
Lundberg,
to her.
yeah, she this was a woman that JFK had an affair with who really helped open him up. And ironically enough, made him a better husband to Jackie.
Well, when JFK was 12 years old, he saw his father having sex with Gloria Swanson, and it upset him terribly. So why do you think he followed in his father's footsteps and became such a womanizer?
Well, as I wrote in the book, the sort of the common wisdom, the sort of the historical bent of this story has always been that, Joe Kennedy was a womanizer, and so then JFK became a womanizer. And as I wrote in the book, I've never really wanted to accept that because I just think that that's so easy. The father did it, so the son does it. I just felt like there's more to it than that. And what I discovered is that it wasn't just because of the father, it was because of the mother as well. It was both parents because they made an arrangement with a lovely woman that I got to know. Her name was Janet DeRose, and she was 100 years old when I interviewed her. And she was hired by Joe and Rose to live in the household to service Joe so that Rose could live her own separate life and travel and have a life separate and apart from her husband. And I think that when you're raised in a family where this is not just the father's idea, but it's the mom's idea, I think that it gives you a very skewed a notion of what a wife should tolerate in a marriage. If Rose Kennedy tolerated that, then what was Jackie supposed to tolerate? I mean, how can you blame JFK for being a bad husband when both his parents had this arrangement that influenced not just him, but the entire brood of Kennedy children? So I think that we're all a product of our environment that doesn't give us a pass. And as I often say, I didn't come to this book to defend JFK, but I came to this book to explain him. And I think that that really explains a lot. Then it's up to us as grown people to do with that what we may, and whether we're going to just let that be our crutch and blame all of our problems on what our parents did, or are we going to become real, evolved people and try to be better and try and try to become better people. And I think that that's what JFK did. But to answer your question, I really think that it was both his parents, not just his father, that influenced him to be the originally unfaithful husband that he was to Jackie.
Now, it's a very, very good point. Now, of all the women you mentioned in the book that JFK had affairs with, you're not so sure that Marilyn Monroe was one of them, even though there's at least 3 dozen books saying that JFK did sleep with her in March 1962 at Bing Crosby's home in Palm Springs. Why are you so doubtful that they had a brief affair?
I'll tell you, Harvey, I interviewed Pat Newcomb, who was Marilyn's very, very close friend, her best friend, actually, and her publicist. She gives very few interviews. And after talking to her, I really have a lot of doubt about the JFK Marilyn affair. I've always had a certain amount of sort of skepticism about it because, Marilyn Monroe was not the best narrator of her own life. She had a lot of emotional problems. And the problem that faced a lot of writers is that she told a lot of her friends that she and JFK and also Bobby were having romantic encounters. Those people then went to people like me and vouched for these stories, not even imagining that maybe they were being lied to by Marilyn. And I don't think that we have enough evidence to support it. It's funny because over the years, writers have whittled this affair down, whittled it down, whittled it down to then becoming just a weekend at Bing Crosby's house, right? And for the last 20 years, that's been the story. Okay, well, it wasn't this big affair. It was this weekend at Bing Crosby's house. And in my book, what I'm saying is we don't even have enough evidence to support that weekend. Pat Newcomb never, and she's 95 years old. I believe she has no reason to lie. She says she doesn't know anything about that weekend. And she would have been very much a part of that weekend as Marilyn's best friend and publicist. And she says she's been reading about this weekend for 60 years and she doesn't even know where Bing Crosby lived. And then there are other sources that we went to for this book. And when the reader reads the book, he'll get a full sort of analysis of this story. But I came away thinking that we don't have enough evidence to support it. Now, of course, they could have slipped off someplace and been together, and I wouldn't know it, and neither would you. We can't be definitive about anything that people do privately. But what I'm saying is that, as far as I'm concerned, we don't have enough evidence to support this affair between JFK and Marilyn.
We know Marilyn Monroe called JFK's home in Hyannisport in April 1962, asking to speak with him. Jackie answered and said he wasn't home. And we know Marilyn called the White House multiple times, asking to speak with JFK. And there's a famous photo of Marilyn with JFK and Bobby Kennedy at a party after the Madison Square Garden's birthday event. Do you know what happened during that encounter?
I only know what people that who were there have said, which is not much. I mean, Marilyn performed for JFK. Happy birthday. Jackie didn't go because she didn't want to endorse what she felt was a manipulation by Bobby and JFK of Marilyn. Jack, can you imagine the first lady did not go to the president's birthday party at Madison Square Garden? If that happened today, it'd be a pretty big headline, And then Marilyn went backstage, and there were lots of people backstage. It wasn't just JFK, Bobby, and Marilyn. There must have been 100 people back there, maybe more. Diane Carroll was there. There were many different celebrities were there, and they had a few words, and then they went on their separate ways. Now, of course, a lot of writers have written over the years that then JFK and Marilyn slipped off to the Carlyle Hotel next door, and they were intimate together there. And I don't believe any of that stuff. I'm just not that guy who will just believe. Look, if you present me with the receipts from the hotel that night, and JFK signed his credit card or whatever to, I don't know. But if you give me some real evidence, picture of Marilyn and JFK going into the hotel would be nice. But short of that, I think we just have to just be really skeptical of this stuff. And here's one more thing I want to say about this. As an historian, I think you have to not just be wedded to the stories that have been headlines for the last 30 years. As new evidence presents itself, history changes. History is evolving as new sources come forward and tell their stories. I think as an historian, you have to be flexible enough to say, okay, I don't think I believe that anymore. And that's what I feel, especially about Marilyn and JFK.
Well, regardless of whether he had an affair with Marilyn, one of the things that really surprised me in your book, Randy, when it comes to JFK's infidelity, is that he had a very positive relationship with his in-laws, Jackie's mother and stepfather. Isn't that unusual given the disrespect he showed to his wife, who was their daughter?
Well, you know how I feel about Janet Auchincloss and Hugh Auchincloss. I mean, I feel very territorial because I feel that I'm the guy that really brought these people to life for the first time in my books. And I think it's really hard, Harvey, when your son-in-law is president of the United States to hold a grudge against him, especially if you're as patriotic as Janet Auchincloss was. Now, she, as you read in this book, they had a very complex relationship. And she was angry at him a lot. She used to say of him, so many women, so little sense, right? She wished he had been a better husband. But, as time went on, he was becoming a better husband. And at the end of our book, I think that there's a real moment between Jackie and her mom when they were planning wedding renewal vow ceremony for their 11th anniversary. And Janet said to Jackie, "My God, after everything that we've all been through, you really love him." She was like awed by it, by her daughter's devotion. And Jackie said something that I think is so heavy and loaded with meaning. She said, "Yes," she said, "but you know what? It's we who made him. It's we who made him." In other words, they were all complicit in all of it. Jackie allowed the women in the White House. Janet allowed her daughter to be in the marriage. It was Janet endorsed the marriage originally. It's not as if they fought all of this, over the years. Jackie allowed Mary Meyer in the White House. Jackie knew all about Joan Lundberg. Jackie knew, Jackie knew, Jackie knew. So I thought this was a really important moment of accountability for Jackie and for Janet when Jackie said, "It's we who made him." And I loved that moment, I mean, anytime a person takes accountability in one of my books, I am there for it. After that is when I think their marriage really started to come together.
You mentioned the baby Arabella, who was stillborn. JFK was vacationing on a yacht with his friends in Europe, and he didn't come home to Jackie for 5 days, which was, as you pointed out, extremely heartless. Do you think Jackie ever forgave him for that behavior?
I'm speculating just based on what the history has told me. I think that she did, because I think that she understood. She had a hard time with this. I mean, she basically they all banished him after that. Janet wouldn't even allow him to stay in the bedroom at Hammersmith. She had him staying up over the garage in the servants' quarters after that happened, the mother-in-law. Jackie wouldn't speak to him. His whole family wouldn't speak to him. Everybody was upset with him at that time. But I think that they began to understand that he was not a terrible person. He had terrible influences as he was being raised. And as he was coming into his own, they began to piece together the reasons why he was who he was. And they began to understand him. And in understanding this guy, they began to forgive him. And I think that is sort of a road to forgiveness, understanding a person, and not just standing in judgment of a person, but trying to understand that person, especially if that person's working to be a better person. Now, if JFK was this guy who just kept blaming his upbringing on all of his bad behavior, he wouldn't have been a great person for me to write about, that's for sure. And he also wouldn't have been a great person in their lives. But as you see, with the unfolding of the story, they began to really love him because they began to admire the way that he changed as a person. And I think that, there's no better story than that.
Yeah, he was sorry. When Jackie wanted to divorce JFK, Joseph Kennedy paid her $100,000 to stay married to Jack, payable on the birth of their first child. Do you think JFK ever found out about that deal?
I don't know. As I wrote in the book, I don't know. It's so funny, because there's a point in all of these stories when I just have to say, I don't know, because I can't know ev I wish I could know everything, but I don't know everything. As I wrote in the book, you have to assume, given JFK's relationship with his father, that his father would have told him. You can't imagine that Joe would not have mentioned it somewhere along the line, but I can only write what I know, and when I don't know something, I always tell the reader, we don't know. And in this particular case, we don't know.
Well, I love the fact that you present us with enough information that we can then assess and speculate on our own. I'll give you another example. You wrote about an ultimatum that Jackie gave JFK about his womanizing, and in particular, the affair with Mary Meyer. She threatened to divorce him if he didn't end it. I'm wondering if you think she ever would have left him.
Well, at that particular time in the book, she was really coming into her own. And JFK was giving her enough reason to believe that she could make that kind of draw that kind of line in the sand. That's a line in the sand that she would not have drawn 5 years earlier. But he was inching his way to becoming a better husband. And I think that by the time that she made that Ultimatum, which was in 1963, she realized that she could make it and that he would not let her down, right? What I think is this, okay, speculation on my part. If he had not changed, she would have stuck by his side throughout the next term if he got reelected, and he probably would have been, but then she would have left. So I think that he would have had 4 more years with her, and then she would have taken off. She would have been finished. So because by 1968, Jackie was a very different person, and I can't imagine Jackie O, right? Even though she would be with Onassis, but the Jackie O persona sticking with this guy who was unfaithful to her. That just was not who she was by that time, you know. So I think that. Since I've written about Jackie and all her different incarnations over the years, I don't think that she would have stayed with him if he had not stopped infidelity.
Which is so interesting that there's so much evolution on both their parts. I want to tell you something. When I was telling my friend Julian Schlossberg, the well-known producer, about the book and about you coming on the show, he said to me that he wanted the public to know that for people of his vintage, and Julian's in his 80s now, they were raised with Presidents Truman and Eisenhower. These were grandfather figures. And when JFK came along, he was young and he was dynamic and he was charismatic, and that he inspired the entire young generation to believe in a better world and to get involved in politics. And I love the fact that your book really emphasizes that. It's not just about his affairs and his evolution as a person, but as a leader, he was unbelievably inspirational and motivational to an entire generation of young people.
Thank you for saying that. You know, that gets lost, you know, because there's so much. And I wanted to make sure I didn't lose that in the book. You know, when he said, "Ask not what you can do for your country, ask what you can do, what your country can do for you," in his inaugural speech, that meant a lot to people. I mean, he developed the Peace Corps. He began making inroads into civil rights actions. His speeches, man, if you look at his speeches on YouTube, he is so aspirational. You know, I mean, this, the, I mean, he really believed in America. But more importantly, I think he believed in Americans. And he was a leader for all people. He wasn't just a leader for the Democratic Party. You know, he went out of his way to be an inclusionary president. You would never hear him denigrate the other side. I mean, that just, you know, I love that about those guys. You know, I mean, he had a lot of the, you know, grandfatherness of Eisenhower and Truman, just in terms of his ability to, you know, galvanize people. But where he was different was in his youthful appeal. And he was really basically the first television president. You know, he was the first president who made all kinds of appearances on TV. And it was so interesting that people told me that when they would, people who are now in their 90s and in their hundreds told me that when they would see him in person and he wasn't in black and white, it was a shock. Because they were so used to seeing him in black and white on TV that, and then when you're standing next to him and he's in full color, it was like, wow, he's a real person. You know, he's not just a black and white image on a television screen. That's how prevalent he was in people's homes at that time. I think he was a great president, and I think he was a great leader. And I think that, but he didn't come in to his position a great leader. He grew into becoming a great leader over not a lot of time, because he was only there for three some years. You know, I just really loved writing about that aspect of him, and I'm so happy, you know, that people can come away from this book with more than just what he was like as in his personal life. Because let me just say this: I think the book is a real primer in time and place. Like, if you want to know about the Kennedy administration, This book is like a textbook. You can just, after you finish this book, you will know everything that you need to know about those years. And that was hard for me because I was very, I mean, I didn't know all the ins and outs of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs and Vietnam and civil rights. I mean, I had to really do a lot of deep dive as a writer to be able to tell these stories in an authoritative way. And after I finished this book, I felt like, wow, you know, whether you like JFK or not, when you read this book, you will know JFK.
No, that's very, very true. You gave a very helpful overview of some of the issues that he had to deal with as president: organized crime, the Cold War, nuclear disarmament, of course, the Bay of Pigs, Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam, and the civil rights movement. I was very intrigued with something you said about the civil rights movement. You said that JFK was conflicted about civil rights. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant was that, you know, he believed in his gut that, you know, all people should be treated equally. But he also understood the times and the political ramifications. And he wanted to get his Civil Rights Act through Congress, but he didn't want to alienate the Democrats and Republicans who didn't believe in civil rights. So he had to find, as I wrote in the book, he really had to thread a needle to try to, you know, bring these people along. And in doing that, many people felt like he didn't have the moral imperative of believing in civil rights. And this was what Martin Luther King said of JFK at the beginning of the JFK administration. Martin Luther King felt like JFK didn't have the moral imperative. But what he was reading in JFK was JFK's trying to figure out, how do you do this when half the country doesn't believe in it? You know, it's hard to imagine now, but maybe not so hard if you think about what's going on in this country right now. Again, I want to say 10 years ago, this would have been hard to imagine, but now maybe not so much, that there are people who believe back then that we were not all created equal. Just as I might say, there are people today who believe that we are not all created equal. And JFK was trying to figure out, how do I get my Civil Rights Act through when half the country doesn't believe in it? And so that's where he was conflicted. That was the conflict right there. And I think he did an incredible job. And toward the end of his life, he was really, you know, speaking out forcefully, saying that, how can we not be treated equal in this country? He gave speeches on TV, you know, when there was a huge uprising in Alabama. And people forget, you know, that there were a lot of conflicts during the JFK administration. And he actually enacted the Insurrection Act, which is something that people talk about today a lot. JFK actually enacted the Insurrection Act in 1962 because of a huge uprising in Alabama when Black students were not being allowed to be admitted into colleges there. And he gave a speech that night in which he really laid it out for the American people that we have got to do better in this country. You know, imagine a president going on television and telling the American people, we've got to do better. I love it. I
Yeah, and
love
I
that.
encourage our viewers to go on YouTube. It's the civil rights speech
Yeah.
televised on June 11th, 1963. It really is a groundbreaking speech. Now, you mentioned in your book that JFK's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage, was not entirely written by him. As an author, does that bother you?
Wow. I guess I should be prepared for that question, but I'm not. Does it
See,
bother
that's why you have to
me?
come on my show first, because I will prepare you.
You preparing me. Now I need an answer for that question.
Well, if I were an author, it would bother me.
I think that I was surprised, but here's what I also think. You know, I've been around long enough to know that there are such a thing as ghostwriters, and there's such a thing as told to,
But do
and I
they
think,
win Pulitzer Prizes?
yeah, I know, right? I think that, you know, I mean, I think the JFK had the original. I looked at the notes in the JFK library. I reviewed all of his handwritten notes, and there are hundreds of pages of handwritten notes for Profiles in Courage that other people then collated and put together and figured out, and I think it's really fair to say that he did not sit there, especially because it was written during a time after his back surgery when there was just so simply no way he would have been able to do this. He didn't sit there at the typewriter and type out this book. I'm sorry, he just did not. Other people did. And I talked to those people in the book who did that for him. But the original genesis of the idea and the different ideas that were put forth were his, but they were put forth by other people. And then he won a Pulitzer Prize for it. And I don't know what to say, Harvey, except thank you for asking that question. And I'm going to have to come up with a good answer now for the next interview.
When Joseph Kennedy was recovering from a stroke, JFK told Joe's doctor, Dr. Robert Wyatt, that he was sure he would die young, that he didn't think he would live past the age of 50. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that JFK always had sort of this fatalistic approach. And I think that, he was sick a lot. He had so many problems, so many physical ailments. He was so debilitated, his back and different Addison's disease and all kinds of issues from the time that he was very young all the way through his life. Very sick. So it's not surprising that he didn't think he was going to last, past 50, just based on how ill he had been for most of his life. But I also think that thinking that way made him want to force as much into his life as he possibly could. And as much sex, as much good stuff and bad stuff, and as much life and living on the dark side, on the wild side, on the good side, all, like JFK, look, man, he lived his life. That's for sure. I mean, you can't, at the end of my book, think to yourself, wow, I wish he had lived his life. The man, he squeezed every single moment into those 40 some years, but I think one of the reasons for that was because he did not think he would make it past 50.
Have you ever had any contact with Caroline Kennedy?
Sure, I have. Yes. Not in recent years. I'm really happy that my books are can be found in the JFK Library, and I know that she's responsible for that. And I've had these experiences of going to the JFK Library, looking for research material, and seeing my books there among all the other hundreds of Kennedy books. Which gives me, which makes me really feel like the Kennedys understand what it is that I do. And while I'm sure that they don't approve of it wholeheartedly, don't forget Jackie was my first editor, And Jackie's told me, as I wrote in my last book, what is the point of a biography if it doesn't tell secrets? And that is such a profound statement coming from a woman who was the most secretive woman in the world, right? But she was able to wear two different hats, the hat of a editor at a publishing company and the hat of an icon. And she understood that good biography invades a person's privacy, right? I mean, that's kind of my job, is to sort of invade a person's privacy, but to do it with compassion and with empathy and context. And as you and I talked about before, not everything I know ends up in a book. Let me tell you, Harvey, I know a lot of stuff. And it doesn't all end up in a book. I only write the stories that I think, illuminate a person's personality and character and tell my reader what it is they need to know. Not every story needs to be told, because I don't have the context. I wasn't there. And a lot of times without context, you can't really tell a balanced account. And if I can't be balanced in my account, then I'm just not going to tell the story at all.
Oh, and that's why I think your books are so valuable and so credible. You presented JFK as a somewhat tortured individual with inner demons he had to deal with in his personal relationships. Do you think he ever found inner peace?
I think that he was on his way to finding inner peace. He used to say that, he was stuck in himself. Like he had, I think what's interesting for me is that there are people who just have no conscience and they act recklessly. And I think that if you have no conscience and you act recklessly, that's an easier way to go because you don't even know how terrible you are. But in JFK's case, he had a conscience and he understood that he was wrong. I mean, he told Joan Kennedy that the way he treated Jackie, he told Joan this in 1963, that it was painful. He said, and by painful, I mean shameful. This was a man who had a conscience, and that made it harder for him. When Joan Lundberg, who we mentioned earlier, said to him, I think you're a good man. He said, no, I'm not. I'm not a good man. Imagine coming to terms with that you're not a good man. You can only come to those terms if you know what a good man is. And you can only come to those terms if you want to be a better man. Because a person who's not a good man, who doesn't care if he's a good man or not, doesn't even know he's not a good man. Do you know what I mean? You've got to have some kind of framework for what goodness is in order to understand that you don't have it, right? So I think that he was on his way. And as you read in the book, there's a moment in the book that I really think it's just a little few sentences where JFK and Jackie are on a beach, and JFK brought out a little table and a mirror, and he's shaving on the beach, and Jackie's standing behind him, running her fingers through his hair. And it's just the two of them, and they're just out there having this moment. And it's just so, you just feel like they were finding their way. As Janet Auchincloss said, when at a party for their 10th anniversary at Hammersmith, as JFK and Jackie were leaving, Janet turned to Hugh Auchincloss and she said, oh, she said, my, it's actually happening. It's actually happening. She could tell that they were actually falling in love with each other. And she said that, my, it's actually happening.
And it's heartbreaking that they were planning a renewal of their marriage vows and it never happened because he was assassinated. Well, Randy, I have only one more question for you, and it's this. You dedicated the book to anyone searching for and ready for second chances. Why?
Well, Harvey, because I think that that's what this book is about. I think that, people in JFK's life were willing to give him second chances, many of them. And he wanted to give himself those same second chances. And in a bigger way, I want the reader to give JFK a second chance because I think that when you think about JFK, you think JFK in Maryland. You think about the infidelity. You think about poor Jackie. You think about what did Jackie know? You think about a lot of, you can have a lot of judgment about JFK. And I did too, because look, I'm a Jackie historian. I've written lots of Jackie books, and I was never happy with the way he treated her. But now that I've written this book and I set out to write this book to understand him, I feel that I really do understand him, and I want to give him a second chance. And I want the reader to give him a second chance. And I think that when you finish this book, you will feel differently about JFK than maybe you felt when you began it.
Well, that's so beautifully said. I have to tell you, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. I know you're getting another chance to go back on top of the New York Times bestseller list, my friend Randy. You've
Thank you.
written a superb book. It's a beautiful companion book to the Jackie book that you released last time you were here. I am thrilled for you. I can see the work and the heart that you put into that book. I loved reading it. Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for taking the time to appear on our show again.
Well, thank you for having me, Harvey. You know, I do lots and lots of interviews, but I got to tell you, as I always say, you're the best. I mean, no, nothing can compare to, a Harvey Brownstone interview because you ask great questions, and also you ask questions that I don't have the answers to, that I can then go back to and have better answers next time. Because, most people don't read the book. I have to tell you, I don't have an issue with that because I understand that this 600 pages, people are busy, and they don't have time. But if a person like you takes the time to read a book and then does a great interview like you just did, I have a lot of admiration for that. So you are one of a kind, man, and I really appreciate you very much.
Well, that means the world to me to hear that from you. Thank you so much. You deserve that kind of respect. You don't get paid to do these interviews. And when my viewers ask me, oh, why do you spend all that time? It must be so time consuming to prepare. I owe that to my guests. They're doing me a favor to come on this show. They don't get anything else for it except hopefully to have their time well spent. And so I really appreciate that you get what I do and why I do it. Thank you again. Please promise me that with every new book you write, you'll be back here.
I'll be back in 2 years because I'm right working on one right now.
Are we
So
allowed to know what it's about?
no, but I will say it's more the same.
Okay, I'm there. Thank you so much again. Our guest has been best-selling author J. Randy Tarabarelli, whose new book, JFK: Public Private Secret, is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. For more information about Randy, please go to his official website, jrandytarabarelli.com. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli of the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my editor, Isaiah Charalampadis, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.